Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Friday, May 23rd, 2014, as we head into the Memorial Day weekend. I gotta say, this has been a really crappy week for progressives in Washington, D.C. Our music to get us started today is from Gorillaz, welcoming Godzilla back to the really big screen. It was a really, really bad week, from my point of view. And front and center was what is billed in newspaper headlines as the House legislation that will curb the NSA surveillance of Americans. And the watered-down USA Freedom Act will do almost nothing of the kind. Oh, there are just a couple of reforms in there. But in the big picture, the collection of our telephone metadata will be a little different. But they can still grab it all. And the need to reform so many aspects of government surveillance in this country is overwhelming. And the legislation that came out is less than modest. And my big question, and I will continue to pursue this in interviews in the weeks that follow, is exactly who watered down the USA Freedom Act? Because when it left the committees, it had, for example, some pretty strong restrictions on telephone record metadata collection. It included some reforms to the FISA court so there would at least be an advocate for the victim of government surveillance, the target. And there were a few other elements in there that, were valuable. But all of that got left on the committee room floor. And as I read the news accounts of what happened this week, here's one quote from a New York Times article. Administration officials led by Robert Litt, the general counsel of the National Intelligence Director, negotiated a flurry of last-minute alterations with lawmakers, focusing on a change to how the bill purports to stop the government from collecting records about Americans in bulk for national security investigations. The bill requires requests for records to be tied to a specific selection term. Well, that is a meaningless phrase, a specific selection term. It could be done by zip code. It could be done by region of the country. It could be done by state. And the NSA says, we won't do that. But these are spies, and spies lie. And from this account, it appears that high-ranking officials from the FBI, NSA, and the White House had private meetings with congressional leaders who just arbitrarily and willy-nilly changed the language in the bill, deleted clauses, and bulldozed the legislative process. And when the Democrats do that to Obamacare, the Republicans scream to high heavens, and I have screamed with them. But when they change key elements of a bill and water it down, and there are no fingerprints on it, it wasn't voted on by a committee, just rammed through to the House floor and passed, that doesn't approach democracy or even the republic that we had, if we can keep it. And so this is a really bad first step. And in Washington, because they're all running for re-election, they tell us, be patient. You know, this we've just started on the path to curbing, to reining in the NSA. Well, I'd be happy to eat this piece of newspaper right here if that becomes true. But I believe that this is the beginning and the end of the feeble attempts to reform and rein in our rogue intelligence community. And as I've said repeatedly, just fixing a few things at the NSA doesn't fix the overall problem. And that is that our government is illegally spying on innocent civilians by the millions on a daily basis. More bad sausage coming out of the factory on Capitol Hill. There is underway a new authorization for the Defense Department, the new NDAA. And for several years, we've been complaining about the 2012 version, which included that Section 1021B that permits the detention of an American charged with terrorism or just accused of terrorism. That person can be held indefinitely without charge or trial at a military base. To his credit, Congressman Adam Smith, a Democrat from Washington State, offered an amendment that unfortunately was defeated. It would have eliminated indefinite detention in the United States and its territories. Anybody that we captured who we suspected of terrorist activity would no longer be subject to indefinite detention, as is now currently the law. And Smith added, this is an enormous amount of power to give the executive to take someone and lock them up without due process. It's an abuse of power, Congressman. And I would suggest that we start by at least carving out protections for American citizens under the Bill of Rights. Obama vowed when he signed the 2012 NDAA that he would not use the indefinite detention powers that were provided by Congress. He acted like he didn't want this power. And then his lawyers fought tooth and nail after Judge Catherine Forrest courageously put an indefinite or a permanent injunction in place on the detention clause in the 2012 NDAA. And Obama's actions don't match his words because they even managed to run that appeal from Carl Mayer on the Chris Hedges case all the way up to the Supreme Court, where a week or two ago the Supremes declined to hear it. Now, what's interesting is that the same Congressman, Adam Smith, offered an amendment that was also defeated related to the closure of Guantanamo. And this week on Wednesday evening at the White House, Jay Carney, the press secretary, said that if this year's defense authorization bill contains unwarranted restrictions regarding Guantanamo detainees, the president will veto the bill. Well, that sounds good, but it's more words. And when was the last time you saw Barack Obama actually veto a bill? I can't think of one. I truly can't. Also in bad news from Washington, the IRS has delayed, beyond this November's elections, efforts to rewrite the rules about these phony nonprofit political groups. Well, they're political groups that create phony nonprofits, let me put it that way, for the sole purpose of obscuring who funds their political operations and the negative television ads that are propelled by these murky nonprofits. And this is a scandal that the Republicans have spun up as a partisan one that is way off base. The IRS has quite a legitimate interest in controlling and restricting the abuse of these political nonprofits. And yet the right spins it that it's only Tea Party groups and conservative groups that have been targeted. Therefore, this is a political witch hunt. And by delaying this further, it just keeps the story, the issue in play all the way till November. It's bad policy and it's bad politics from this administration. Let's name some names. Alan Van Tress, Dan Shannon, Bernice Del Orto, Diane Morris. They're all subscribers to the Peter B. Collins podcast. If you haven't heard your name here, you can change that, and I wish you would. Go to my website, peterbcollins.com. Click on the link that says sign up right under my mugshot there in the upper left-hand corner. You get a choice, $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever suits your budget. Our best deal is the $50 annual subscription. And if you get a new annual subscription and you live in the U.S., I will send you bonus gifts like John Dist's rock and roll CD, Red Flag. And while it lasts, a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans from Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. Sign up today. I truly need your support. Here's another disappointing story from Washington. We saw some expression of courage by Judge Gladys Kessler on the Federal District Court in D.C. when she ordered the Pentagon to release videotapes of the grisly force-feeding of hunger-striking inmates at Guantanamo. And for a moment, she ordered them to stop force-feeding Jihad Ahmed Diab, a Syrian national who has been held without charge at Guantanamo for 12 years. He was recommended for release back in 2009. And he's still there, and he'd rather die than stay there. And I believe it's a fundamental human right to decide if you want to refuse food and sustenance because the overwhelming conditions of your life are so hopeless. But Judge Kessler said that she faced an anguishing Hobson's choice to keep the order in place as the legal fight continues and risk his death, or to lift it and allow the military to take steps to keep him alive using the force-feeding procedures that are so brutal. And this is despite the fact that the Pentagon has refused to change its procedures. Judge Kessler asked the military to negotiate a compromise over its procedures with Diab and his representatives. He had asked to be fed at the base hospital without being strapped into a restraint chair and without having the feeding tube inserted and removed each time, which, as I have told you, is excruciating. It's been done to me just a couple of times. But the judge angrily notes the Department of Defense refused to make these changes. And regarding the videotapes of cell extractions and force feeding, Judge Kessler has ordered the military to turn 34 of those tapes over to the lawyers for Diab. But Diab says the tapes might not show everything. He says the medical staff and guards turn the cameras off when they're forcing the tube into him and turn them on only when he has stopped resisting. Games are being played. Lives hang in the balance. And the ultimate barbaric behavior of the United States is once again highlighted. And the last ugly thing from Washington this week, it's hardly the last, but it's the last on my list, is the suiting up for the summer blockbuster called Benghazi. And as I pointed out earlier this week, for the first time we're seeing the corporate media note that our support for the overthrow of Gaddafi in Libya was a big mistake. It's left a failed state with these tribal militias running around trying to grab power. And we won't do anything about that. We won't acknowledge our failed policy. Instead, Republicans will try to score political points over the incident on September 11th, 2012 in Benghazi, Libya. Well, there is a split between Glenn Greenwald, the keeper of the Ed Snowden cache, and the folks at WikiLeaks. And true to its promise, WikiLeaks revealed late yesterday, the unidentified country that is subject to the NSA's full take. Full take means they record every phone call that occurs in that country 24/7. And we knew from the revelations of Mystic and its sub-programs by Glenn Greenwald that the Bahamas is one of the two countries where full take is in effect. And because Glenn Greenwald refused to disclose the other country due to what he said was a credible risk of increased violence or that people would die, it caused a very bad reaction at WikiLeaks, and it's not clear if this is Julian Assange or others. So last night, the organization issued a statement claiming that Country X is Afghanistan. And it added this quote, "The National Security Agency has been recording and storing nearly all the domestic and international phone calls from two or more target countries as of 2013. Both the Washington Post and The Intercept have censored the name of one of the victim states, which the latter publication refers to as Country X. Both the Post and The Intercept stated that they had censored the name of the victim country at the request of the U.S. government. Such censorship strips a nation of its right of self-determination on a matter which affects its whole population." Now, I generally agree with WikiLeaks here. And at this point, if it's true that the nation is Afghanistan, I'm not sure what direct concerns Glenn Greenwald had or has. Because I don't find it that startling that in a nation we've occupied for more than 11 years, that we've set up total surveillance coverage. Honestly, I thought it was going to be a nation like Pakistan or even one of our allies. And so if this cat is out of the bag, we're going to find out in real time if the risks that were cited are actually experienced. And there's a gamble here. I don't like to play games with people's lives. And so this is a tough call, I have to say. And I'm sure Glenn Greenwald will be responding to that in the coming days. He's on a book tour of the United States, due here in San Francisco in mid-June. And I have put in a request for an interview with Mr. Greenwald when he visits here. Today, I am releasing to subscribers a great interview, if I do say so myself, with a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter from the New York Times, Ms. Jo Becker. And she was embedded, if you will, with the team of lawyers who successfully fought to overturn California's Proposition 8, which ended marriage rights for same-sex couples here. And the risks that were taken to take on the struggle are the fascinating subject of this book. Here's an excerpt from my conversation with Jo Becker.
I had done the first story of how Ted Olson, of course, one of the lawyers who fought to overturn Prop 8, and a guy liberals love to hate because he'd won Bush v. Gore for Bush. Mm-hmm. I wrote the first story about sort of how he came to embrace this cause for the New York Times. And I just found I couldn't let it go. I thought this was such an interesting group of people. I got to meet the plaintiffs in the reporting of that story. And, you know, at the time, this was a pretty radical sort of move. And no one kind of knew how it would turn out. And so I wanted to follow them. So I went and I asked them, you know, I talked to them. I said, you know, I'd really like to write a book, but if you agree that you would like to, you know, that there's a reason to do a book and that I'm the right person, I really have to be in the room for everything. So in the rooms that the lawyers debated strategy, in the rooms as the political operatives who you know, used this litigation to mount a really impressive public education campaign, and with the plaintiffs, you know, on these incredibly tension-filled rides to the courthouses and in their homes as you know, the stress of 4.5 years of kind of the ups and downs of this case, like, weighed on them. And it was just a remarkable story. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, they agreed to this, which is, you know, if you think about it, really unusual. Lawyers don't want reporters or any outsiders in the middle of their strategy sessions because it can waive if anybody were to find out about it, you know, their privilege, mm-hmm. the lawyer-client privilege. And so they were, you know, of course, it was a difficult decision for them to make, and the same thing is true for the political operatives. I mean, you know, they don't want necessarily a reporter there as they're working, you know, my colleagues in the press and trying to sort of plot strategy. But the reason that they all decided to do this, even though if you cast back, really at that time no one knew how it would turn out. They could have been heroes or they could have been complete goats and been dumb enough to invite a reporter and to document all that.
You can hear the full interview with Jo Becker about her book, Forcing the Spring. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com and all of our other media outlets, including iTunes, Stitcher, and the TuneIn platform. And next week, if I remember, I'll share an email from a listener who has another zippy way, using an Android phone, to download and listen to the Peter B. Collins podcast on his car radio. Chuck Hagel, the Secretary of Defense, gave the commencement address at the U.S. Naval Academy today, and he told the graduating midshipmen that he is counting on them to lead in helping eliminate sexual harassment and sexual assault of your sisters and brothers in uniform. And what's important here is that a few minutes after he spoke, a young woman who had been at the center of a highly publicized rape case walked across the stage to receive her diploma. The man accused but acquitted of raping her, Joshua Tate, resigned from the Naval Academy after the trial was concluded. We reported to you yesterday about the interesting case of Aaron McFarlane, now working for the FBI, and we know that because while they tried to obscure his identity, we now know that Aaron McFarlane is the FBI agent who shot and killed Ibrahim Todashev in Orlando, Florida last May. And San Francisco's Chronicle today reports that Oakland officials are investigating Aaron McFarlane because he gets a check every month from the city of Oakland on an annual payout of $52,000 on a disability claim. And the question is, how could a guy who is too disabled to continue working on the Oakland Police Department get hired by the FBI, meet their rigorous physical standards, and did they investigate his past? His involvement with the scandal called the Riders scandal, and the fact that he took the Fifth Amendment when he tried to testify on behalf of officers accused in the Riders scandal. He took the Fifth when a prosecutor suggested he had lied on a police report. Now, we're told that the squeaky, squeaky clean standards of the FBI, both on a physical and ethical basis, would never permit a guy like Aaron McFarlane to get hired. But he's been working at the FBI for at least 4 years now, maybe longer. 6 years. And he is at the center of what we were told was a justified shooting. And finally today, as we get a three-day weekend and honor our veterans, some elections will be going on in Ukraine. They will hold the long-awaited election so that they can replace the rump self-appointed government in Kiev with people who have been elected by at least part of the country. It's an open question whether voters will turn out and ballots will actually be counted in the eastern part of Ukraine. But Putin in Moscow indicated today, actually from St. Petersburg, that he will respect the results of the Ukrainian election. Now, the choices are between Yulia Tymoshenko and the chocolate guy, and neither one of them really represents a path forward, at least from my point of view. And violence has been building up in Ukraine as the election approaches, so we'll be watching this one very carefully. Meanwhile, there are also elections scheduled in Colombia, where accusations of bribes from drug traffickers, spying, and email hacking have turned the presidential election into an ugly slugfest. And then next week, voters will go to the polls to rubber stamp the ascension of Field Marshal Abdel Fattah el-Sisi as the new dictator of Egypt. They're going to go through the motions of an election. There is a nominal opponent. But al-Sisi, despite the fact that polls show that he doesn't even have majority support, you can imagine he's going to roll up a 60-70% margin in the what will be a disputed election. And they've sentenced Mubarak. Now they just have to deal with Mohamed Morsi, who was the last, apparently, honestly elected leader of Egypt. and the U.S. remains generally silent in the face of the mass trials leading to mass death sentences for hundreds of people in trials that last less than 10 minutes. And we haven't even admitted that last July 3rd's coup in Cairo was a coup. So I wish I could end this on a happy note, friends, but that's the way the world is today, at least as your humble host sees it. I'm Peter B. Collins. Thanks for listening.
Happy trails.